Thank you very much for joining me here for a chat, Dr. Lynn Kelly, who is a research fellow at the La Trobe University, and who is into ways of knowing in a way that I find to be really important, or to have very wide importance in our days. So thank you for taking this time, even though I messed up the time and came a little bit late. And so,
not a problem, Rune. It's fun to be here.
Cool, great. Well, could you just start by outlining a little bit what it is that your angle on knowledge and basically retaining information that the in your work, like exactly what is it that you are doing, how is it you think with knowledge and memory?
I think I'll start with how I ended up here, was that I was going to write a book on Indigenous knowledge of animals. I'm a science writer. And I started realizing that they knew massive amounts, huge numbers of animals, plants, navigation, all this stuff. And I have a naturally really bad memory. And so the book I was supposed to be writing and the PhD I was supposed to be doing got derailed completely by the question, how the hell are they managing this? Because I can't remember all this stuff, and discover that they have a whole suite of really effective methods to retain knowledge, and it's heavily linked to the landscape, something that we have dismissed in contemporary times. And now that I've started practicing these methods, I am astounded what I can do and astounded how little I was aware of my physical surroundings.
Cool. So how, and as I understand, particularly in Australia, Indigenous peoples have these ways of coding knowledge, both into landscapes and objects. Can you describe what exactly is it that they know how to do that we have forgotten? Or
what I'm going to explain is also global. And yeah. I've shown in my research that Indigenous cultures the whole world over have used exactly these methods, not by chatting to each other. It's because we're all using the same human brain. And the beauty is we've got it now. We're just not using it fully. So the simplified version of it's what is known as the method of loci or memory palaces, which are what the ancient Greeks and Romans use and all modern memory champions. I've done memory competitions as well. And what happens is you, at each location, so if I'm moving around this room, at each location, I associate a piece of information. So if I'm putting the countries of the world in population order, which I'm not sure if India's taken over now, but let's say I start with China at the door, I make some association between China and that door, like a meal arriving. The next one's India. I get to the table, which is America. So I imagine Donald Trump sitting here, which is a bit upsetting, and so on. The brain has place cells in it. Our natural way of remembering is associating with place.
Yeah.
And that's what all memory champions do, what all the Greek and Roman mob did, orators. And they are credited with inventing this method, but they didn't invent it. They wrote it down for the first time. But Australian Aboriginal songlines and the equivalent elsewhere, but I'll start with songlines, are exactly the same thing, but much more sophisticated. So the Aboriginal people will take the landscape and go from river, put, say, China, their equivalent, bit of knowledge there, and on to the next location and put India in the next location and put America, except they'll put more interesting things probably. And they will do exactly the same, but they will add every other effective method we know. Music is far more effective way of memorizing than straight text. So they will sing the information and they will sing the locations so they get them. That's why they're called song lines. That's not the Aboriginal term. That's the Western term. They will dance the information because embodied knowledge, I think you've talked to Tyson Yunkaporter, who goes on about this at length, and rightly so. They will dance the information. They will communicate it between each other. So they will use the emotional connectiveness. They will paint it. So they will use art. And they're using what my latest research has shown, we are genetically encoded to use that combination of information and all Indigenous cultures the world over. So in America, they're called Native Pilgrimage Trails. The ancient Inca called them Seques, C-E-Q-U-E-S. No one could tell me how to pronounce it. But they had all of Cusco marked out that way. All the Pacific Islands have ceremonial roads. So they're all using these methods with that combination because that's the way our brain has evolved.
Yeah.
And it's the most effective learning methods going.
I remember I heard you in an interview somewhere saying that our brain, the cognitive makeup of our brain, basically has spatiality in a way that no other organism has. That spatiality is just like a foundational way of mode of human cognition, or condition perhaps of human cognition.
Yes, we're genetically encoded to this, and that's what my last 3 years of research has been in my next book. And it's a gene that there's one that does language, but there's a gene that separates us from the chimpanzees, which enhanced our spatial abilities, which I'll come back to the art and the landscape and all that, our musical abilities massively. And there is no other animal that does music the way we do. I can, if you ask me, I'll go into why it's not birds and whales and insects and that. But we put together a suite of musical abilities and narrative.
Yeah.
And so we're combining these things in a way that is so valuable that in this gene, when this mutation originally happened, causes a disorder that's
okay.
Crap, basically. And but evolution does a cost-benefit analysis. And the benefit to humans is so big that we're willing to let some people get horrible diseases. We know this through sickle cell anemia. There's other examples of evolution changing something that sacrifices a few people for the good of the whole,
okay.
Which isn't very nice, but that's what matters.
Yeah.
And yes,
I get it.
So we have the 2014 Nobel Prize for Medicine talked about the human place cells, the place cells. Other animals do have this. They don't use it to our extent. For example, which gives you spatial, this associating with place is biologically driven.
Yeah.
So a chimpanzee could take a twig and strip off the leaves and everything and use it as a tool. They will not take a lump of wood and carve it into a tool. They will not take stone and create bifaces and things like that.
Okay.
No other creature has this spatiality.
Oh, wow. So that's spatiality.
I just made that word up, I think.
Yeah.
It's a good word, though.
Yeah, but spaceness.
The ability to rotate stuff.
Yeah, and shaping a pot or creating a basket or making a club or something like that, all these, this tool making is basically based on our sense of spatiality that we can take an object and turn it around, imagine that there can be something inside this basket and these things. Wow.
So you can take
that
a lot of
amazing insight. Because that basically puts spatiality at the absolute root of what it means to be human, because using tools is our primary foundational characteristic as a species.
If you look at the cave art and stuff, go back, well, here you go back long before the Europe ones. And the beauty of Australia is that we've got these massive cave art panels that date back 10,000 years, a lot longer. But we still have the oral tradition. They could tell us what they were doing, and they're using them to encode information, masses of information, and then run commentaries above it. So you've talked to Tyson Yunkaporta, who writes about the philosophical way above. Now, if you read what the Brits wrote about Australian Aboriginal people, that they were the lowest of the low and didn't have any science or any, you know, it's because they didn't understand. All humans use these methods.
Yeah.
But if you look at the caves like in Europe, Lascaux and Altamira and Chevet and so on, at the points, they're all panels. So we get pictures of the bison or the you know, horse heads that are magnificent because we respond to that. What they don't show you is that they're panels with a whole stack of other stuff there that they're using as a blackboard. And the points of resonance, music, there's performance spaces marked out, and the points of resonance are where there is art. The art tones in. So they are performing. They're also going way, way, way into these dark caves and can navigate their way out. There are no bodies left in there. And that's, again, the human spatial abilities.
Amazing.
And you've got
amazing.
This all over the world.
Yeah.
Now, the longest gallery, these galleries, I'm saying you should look at art in terms of galleries, and this is what we can do for education now is grab back this method. The longest one I know of is in America, and it's 74 kilometres long. It's called Nine Mile Canyon, if you want to look it up. No, but it's a lot longer. 74 kilometres of art gallery.
Wow.
So that is an encyclopedia.
It's a library. Yeah, it's a library. Wow.
Exactly.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah.
And you'll find I've shown that China, America, here, everywhere, you get exactly the same pattern because the human brain's the same.
Yeah.
But what we've done with education because of writing is said, sit down, sit still, and write neatly, which suited me. I loved it that way.
Yeah.
But we're not taking advantage of the fact that music, and art and these panels
are so
evocative.
Yeah. I have a friend.
We could learn much better.
Yeah. I have a friend named Helga Hansegård who is practicing traditional dancing in Norway. And so they have this very actually acrobatic traditional dancing style in Norway. You need to be a man in your 20s and very, very fit in order to even do it. And he is basically going around in the Scandinavian peninsula, finding ancient rock carvings, and he recognizes some of the movements that he knows. So
he's basically
almost dancing back into being these ancient movement. I mean, obviously, it's difficult to know the precision with which what he's seeing on the rock carvings matches his current practice, but I think I just wanted to spit that in, but I think
that's what the embodied knowledge, since I've been adding this, I've been setting up memory palaces galore, song lines here for me to learn a whole lot of things to test out these methods. Now my longest one is to learn Chinese. I decided to take on the hardest thing I could come up with for someone like me. The school languages were impossible, but Tyson said to me, you've got to add in these other things. So I've started adding lots of movement in, and yes, he's right, and started in place responding, and I'm finding a response to that landscape. But he also said I needed to add in emotional connection.
Yeah.
Because that dancing and what you have with the groups is people like your friend that are the specialists, but everybody's involved. They're not sitting still watching.
Yeah.
And that... Anyway, I said to Tyson, nobody's going to want to come and learn Chinese with me. But I started doing it. People would be in their gardens and I'd be staying there staring at their houses. So instead of pretending I wasn't, I went over and said, I'm not casing your joint. I don't know if you have that expression here, but I'm not looking at your place to rob it. I'm using a memory palace. And they would start talking to me about it. So one place I was putting in the word for love.
Yeah.
And the woman, who I didn't know until then, her name's Anna, said to me, oh, I love orchids. I absolutely love native orchids and I work with. So she became part of the story there.
Yeah.
And suddenly that location became so much stronger because I'd had an emotional exchange there.
Yeah.
So the difference between the Greek and Roman memory palaces and the Native American and Aboriginal songlines is they add the music, the art, the interactions, the movement, and put it all together.
I think it is an absolutely momentous insight, that idea, that spatiality, and then naturally emotion, human movement, which obviously is another way of being in space, it's all using spatiality, you might say, dance, music, that knowledge it's like, I think in Tyson terms, it's very holistic. There's one
exactly.
complex of human practice and knowledge and perception and being. Where
and it's been difficult for somebody brought up the Western. I've also looked at neurodiversity in this light, but we'll get there later maybe. But somebody like me that's very neurotypical, that likes sitting still, writing beautifully neat notes and sitting exams, it was very hard for me to start doing these things. But with Tyson pushing and Margot Neal, my co-author, I've written a book sometimes called, and then there's a children's version, younger reader versions, which I've written with Margot Neal, the Aboriginal co-author.
Yeah.
With them both pushing me, every time I do it, it gets more and more. So if I want to add America to this table, instead of sitting down and writing on my neat notes, this is America and here's Donald Trump, if I stand up and start talking to him, especially if I start yelling at him, I only have to do that once and there is no way I will lose that memory.
Yeah.
The difference just standing up and engaging with the physical space is extraordinary.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you're not aware of your physical space. So I've got a house up further that I had to put in Tao. For anyone who's the knows Chinese who's watching, I'm doing the tones, Tao, which is arrive. And I get to the house, and in my head I've got an image of the house, but except I haven't because I have no proper images. But anyway, I know the house. But when I get there, there's a tree I had never noticed. And on the ground, there are roots that look just like a dragon. For me, that's a dragon in love. Doesn't matter why, but that's the code I have to use. There's a dragon's claw and a dragon's tail. Now, I had never noticed the tree, and I'd certainly never noticed the shapes of the roots. So just trying to add that one concept made me engage, and then I got a buzz out of it. I was absolutely rapt that there was my dragon hugging, my tree hugging dragon. So that whole, it's what, 2 or 3 minutes at most. There is no way I have lost that word. There's no way I've lost the character for it or the pinyin. It's all encoded by me physically being there and doing the actions and engaging with my landscape.
Yeah. So I think part of why I like immediately got fascinated with your work and like I already had encountered this whole way of operating in Tyson's work, and I had tried to start doing it but found it a little bit difficult to get into it, get rolling with it. But it seems to me that you are kind of outlining strategies to get started on it.
Don't try and put it all in at once. Start using the Greek and Roman methods and just start putting in at locations, but be aware and it will start to happen because you are biologically encoded to behave that way. Totally. So the first time it happened to me, I was putting in, I've got a complete field guide to our birds, and I was putting in a little sanderling, which is a bird that goes up and down the beach. And this was before I knew Tyson or Margot, and I just started dancing up and down, imitating a sanderling at that location, and found that really worked. So I started imitating the birds at different places. So my biology, once I started relaxing, told me to do this. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I've done it much more under the guidance of Indigenous colleagues.
Yeah.
The interesting thing, I'm working with a Tlingit elder, that's T-L-I-N-G-I-T.
Yeah.
That's the totem pole mob up in Southeast Alaska. And he is doing exactly the same things as the Australian Aboriginal, dating it back over 10,000 years because they've got stories that go back to the floods at the end of the Ice Age and so on, using all the same sorts of methods, and there's no contact ever between them. Yeah. We are biologically encoded to engage with our landscape. Yeah.
I think that part of the potential of this is that when we have people like me, you know, majority white racialized populations, there are a lot of us, and we have been detached from these indigenous ways of knowing. Now, I think that what your work can basically do is it can basically make very direct paths into these ways of knowing, where instead of like I don't know, imagining ourselves into some different weird cultural space that is far away of us, far away from us, we can sort of step directly into a way of knowing things, a way of doing that thing of knowing, which brings indigenous, or in our case, not indigenous, but traditional ways of knowing back into us. And that, I think that there's a huge craving for this in our age. So basically, there's a UN, it's valorized in the UN. I heard that the term indigenous knowledge was used 750 times in the last UN climate reports and so on. And so I think that, like, I'm part of the reason I'm trying to immerse in your work is because I want to try to start basically working with it as course material, thinking we have indigenous ways of knowing in our own known tradition. We can perhaps reclaim them or regain them or retrieve them by working with some of these technologies.
Yeah, well, I've been doing it in schools.
Yeah.
It's a few really astounding things happen. Firstly, the very active kids love it because we're physically moving around, but they're engaging with the curriculum. One really amazing thing came out of it that I've now looked into further and understand is the dyslexic students absolutely fly with this stuff.
Oh, wow.
Now, yeah. I've started looking at the evolutionary benefits, you know, of diversity.
Yeah.
Now, dyslexic students are very strong spatially.
Okay.
So until writing, they would have been our most gifted. They navigate better. But with these memory palaces or song lines, I had one girl whose self-esteem was appallingly low because everybody had told her she was dumb. And we did the song line and she was doing it fine. And then she found that she was doing it way better than anyone else.
Yeah.
And what it did for her self-esteem, it's so easy. Every school already has the buildings and the grounds there that they can use. It will cost them nothing to implement. And totally. It works a treat. We did history round and then all sorts of other things. The kids put in when the first flushing toilet was there while we're putting in world wars and things. The kids were adding the first Marvel comic. But that was fine. It all worked. But it also works for the ADHD end of the spectrum, the very physically active. And it works for the dyslexic. I can go into a whole lot of diversities and why they work differently and why evolution kept them in.
So it actually explores applies the human potential for knowledge in a fuller way than our current schooling system.
And the potential as a population, as a group, not as individuals.
Exactly.
Now, that doesn't mean individuals don't have rights and positions in it too.
No.
But if you look at autism, where they repeat and repeat and repeat and don't like change, you've got ADHD who are performing madly and want everything in but don't stick to anything, and us lot in the middle, plus the dyslexics who have got these spatial abilities. So you'll find architects, a lot of them can't spell. Because dyslexia is very high proportion.
The two dyslexic people I know, they're both in leadership position. I thought about it all. How come that,
So if we start looking at our classroom as, instead of we need to make these people who don't fit, we start looking at adding in these indigenous ways, because in an indigenous culture, they have these combinations. So your friend that's the performer, that will be a specialist art. So they'll have specialists, then all of us doing it a bit, and the few specialists that we think are wonderful. The autistic boy I've been working with is the best birder around at 13. He knows his bird identification and calls better than anybody else. He has all the problems associated, and we can't pretend there aren't problems. But that ability would be so hugely valued if we worked as a population.
Yeah.
But we don't. We want everybody to be the same.
Yeah.
And none of our political leaders are on any diverse spectrums or are perform. I don't know about there. We have no performers. We have no musicians, no artists, no neurodiverse.
Yeah.
All of our politicians fit the same cognitive mold.
And that was it a boy you mentioned there in other than modern societies like the ones that you describe in Memory Craft that I've been reading, he would have socially very high status just as a function of the his capacity to remember a lot of information. Just retaining information would and be would so leave. Important. So that would also have the social effect. It would probably have like a literally healing socially effect on those problems that he also has.
Yes, but also they will respect, like, what are they called with the Greek people up in the caves that they went to?
Hermites?
Not gurus, but the hermits and things that knew lots and lots. They were almost certainly autistic.
Yeah.
So valuing diversity, but these methods do that. If you think back what I said about the songlines, we're using spatial ability, music, knowledge, but also running commentaries above it because all of those stories will have an ethical and moral dimension to them.
Yeah.
All meshed together instead of me as I did engineering and then physics and maths. Until I was about 60, my whole world was physics and maths and computers. And it's only now that this has all happened that my world's changed because I'm integrating all these knowledge systems.
Yeah.
And that's something that we've lost.
It's absolutely beautiful that also that the diversity of human expression and cognition and is given more room in this particular way of knowing thing that sort of creates a multi-sided complex of human action and
so, yes, so some people dance really well, but everyone dances. Some people do art really well, but everyone does art.
Exactly.
In our society, if you're no good at art, well, you don't do it because that's what the good people do. But they've turned it into mostly entertainment, just pretty pictures, which is, and I've shown the research, that only happens with literacy. The same with music. We sit there as an audience while the people who are crash hot at it are up the top. Some groups will move around a lot more. With Indigenous cultures, you will have leaders that are the strong performers, but everybody will be engaged, and that embodiment causes emotional responses which aid knowledge recall.
Yeah, cool. What I've been trying to do on my channel and also with people I'm talking to and so on, is I'm trying to basically think, how can we as majority people, as people that are racialized as white, how can we actually get concrete about learning from guys like Tyson Juncker-Porter and Robin Kimmerer and these different indigenous groups who are today, their knowledge have become so much more available to wider audiences than it was, say, in my youth. It was like today we can actually pick up Sand Talk and it's full of humor and wisdom and play and so on. And I think we need to find ways or develop the ways of saying, okay, so how can we start knowing in those ways? How can we start being in relation with the landscapes in those ways? And I think that your books look like it could be a very, very good place to start. Like I started with Memory Craft, but just before we started the recording here, you mentioned that in fact some of your other books go a little bit more directly into how do we actually relate with landscapes. Can you talk about how does one get started on basically knowing things in the landscape? How does one reopen song lines? I don't know, perhaps it's some of Tyson's indigenous aunties I should just ask this exact question to, but what would be your bit for how to get started?
we can't open their song lines.
No, no.
We can set up our own and start to experience it. To get started, the easiest one for me was the countries of the world. I got the Wikipedia list of the countries of the world in population order, from biggest to smallest, and I just started moving around the house and down the street and associating each one. And I only did half a dozen a day at the most, but didn't take long till I had all of them. And what started happening was somebody would tell me something about Vietnam, for example. My head would go straight to that location and add the information on. Anything on the news, it had a hook. And once you've got a hook, not only can you add things on, but you're much more interested too. So just start. The secret isn't look for something mind-boggling. Just start by encoding anything you can, but take time.
Yeah.
Because it's all the senses. One of my Indigenous colleagues that helped me a lot, Nungarai, she's Walpuri, she said, now, are you listening to the trees and the grasses and hear the difference? And I thought, well, there's no way I'm going to manage that. She said, well, try sitting still and actually trying it. I was still for about 2 minutes before I started being able to tell that that was a tree and that was a grass, and I'd never listened. I certainly am not at the stage of being able to tell which tree and which grass, which, of course, Indigenous people can. So it's just start, and it will start, and you have to learn to relax and stop trying to do it the old way. We can do both. I'm not saying schools give up literacy. Far from it.
No, I'm saying
we can have it all. We can enhance what we're doing massively. Yeah. And I've watched it in schools and universities doing exactly that.
Like, when I've been reading your book and reflecting on how knowledge has moved in the last couple of millennia for Eurodescendant people, two things appear to me. One is that there is a growing detachment of knowledge from knowledge actually being in us and being in our landscapes, to being on parchment, then being on printed, then being in Google, and here it's almost completely detached from us. It's as if we don't even own it anymore. There's an algorithm system somewhere that owns it. And then the challenge would be to basically move it back into us somehow. So that's the one thing that sort of occurred to me. The other thing is that writing in itself, in its emergence, seemed to almost support basically this way of knowing. You have the memory alphabet as one thing, and another thing is you talk about how in the Middle Ages people were extremely invested in memory, which makes sense. If you had to travel to France, find a monastery library like In the Name of the Rose, go and read the book one time, and because that book cost as much as, you know, 2 years production of an average French village, right? You can't just pick it up from a street shop or something like that. Then, in order to basically be able to apply that knowledge, you need actually a very, very high level of capacity to retain that knowledge. So it seems to me that and that could probably be projected also into our age, that we could, for instance, we could apply some of our technology. Like if I wanted to regain some of that close land connected knowledge that some of your Indigenous friends totally have, I could take my smartphone, install an app that recognizes plants. I could then go out and start learning those plants. But then if I say I want to memorize that knowledge and I want to layer it in those places and in those plants so that I recall it, then I'm using this very current method to basically bring that knowledge back into embodiment, into my own, or even like you say with dancing and so on. Yeah, this is just a couple of thoughts of how to start working with this stuff.
I agree. We've got to be careful. I keep getting asked, why do you want to memorize anything when we've got Google? With Google or any other search engine, if you search for something that exists and you get the information that exists, you're funneled into something. creativity involves putting different ideas together. You can't do that with Google. You can't do it unless those different ideas are somewhere in your brain at the same time and you start seeing patterns and you start asking questions. And that's what also happens with these systems is I started asking questions. The eighth biggest country in the world by population is Bangladesh. When I put Bangladesh in, my question was, I know nothing about Bangladesh, and it's the eighth biggest by population, you know, about the same as Russia, Japan, way bigger than England and Spain, all these countries that have had so much impact. Why? And I had to go and do the research. And that's what happens when different ideas start to mess about. So Google and your iPhone and everything, or your phone are very useful, but unless you've got them in memory, you can't start to see new patterns. We cannot create solutions to our problems. Now look at dementia. The last thing that goes seems to be music, because people that are completely non-responsive will respond to familiar music, and astoundingly so.
Okay. Yeah.
They'll respond to physical places that are familiar.
Okay.
So we are, these are very deeply embedded skills. They will not respond to writing in the same way. So writing caused the change. And this is one of the reasons I learned Chinese, because literacy was very, very low in China till the 1950s. And when Mao Zedong raised the literacy rate massively. So my argument was then, these other methods must have still been going on in China, because even though they had writing for thousands of years, a very small elite could use it.
Yeah.
And yes, they had performing street performers, and that spread the news and spread the information and taught them their history and all the rest. These methods were going on right up into the 1950s, photographed, documented. It took me a bit to find them. So we can have both.
Great. Awesome. Let me describe one project that I started. This was before I encountered your work. I got the idea that I wanted to try to use some of Tyson's methods. And I just want to ask you, how should I move on with this? Okay, so what I did was I took a concept in Old Norse, which is a staff. So a staff is both a cosmological concept. So the world is built as a tree, and there's a whole cosmological associations around the idea of a staff. Letters, runes, are also called staffs. And the alliterating letters are called the staff rhymes. So I took two staffs, and then I wanted to memorize the entire poem of the Höfðamál, which is 165 stanzas, and I thought, okay, so I'm on these staffs, I'm gonna cut only the alliterating parts of each stanza. So I make one symbol that has the alliterating parts, and then I will learn how to sing it. So I embody it. I take the radical alliterating parts, and then I will learn how to sing it. Now, part of my problem was time. I didn't have it would take a long time to do this. But my idea was I will use this also as a mean for becoming better at the language, the grammar. I will basically use this as a path into the grammar. But I kind of got stuck in it a little bit. I found traditional singing forms that are actually made to sing this ancient poem. Or they're not made to, they work with it, and they survived in some parts of Norway and so on. So what would be your advice in order to better that process? Because I started, but then I got stuck a little bit. I didn't actually manage to get very far in it.
You've started with something that's probably the most difficult thing you could try, and that's word for word.
Okay.
Because Indigenous people will talk about concepts and stories, but the story is never the same. I'll describe it the way Margot, my co-author on Songlines, describes it. She says the information, the skeleton, like the human skeleton, is the same for everyone. So the information encoded in that story is the same, but the flesh each performer puts on it is individual to make it entertaining than that. So the information will stay the same, but the actual language and performance that will vary a bit. You've tried to make everything the same, keeping every word the same. That makes it much, much more difficult.
Okay.
And I would suggest...
I should start a little bit less ambitiously, perhaps.
With the concept of each stanza or with something completely different. But okay. Word for word is almost never done with Indigenous cultures.
Okay.
And it certainly makes it a lot more difficult.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks a lot. I've been thinking about these methods and how to apply them in different ways. And like here in Northern Europe, in places like England or Denmark or Norway and so on, there's quite a lot of sacred landscape. There's a lot of ancient burial grounds all over the place and names on places that leads back to mythic beings and so on. And so part of what I've been thinking was that, well, if you have myths about specific, if you have mythology, then that is narrative. You could memorize narratives by basically going to those landscapes and using those landscapes as ways to memorize it. That's one.
And that's what mythology is. It's a way to make information more memorable. If you do information about water, water's got no character. If you make it a water nymph, the same information has now got personality and character.
Yeah.
And that makes it more memorable. Now, they're in Scandinavia, you know, the Neolithic ships, you know, the stone. Instead of looking at them as a whole, try walking them and taking each of them as a location, because stones, each stone will be different.
Yeah.
And you will, if you start thinking about dinosaurs and look at a stone, you will find the shape of a dinosaur in there somewhere.
Yeah.
And this is what my Klingered elder talks about with the totem poles, how you use the images to memorize the whole thing. So those in the memory code, I talk a lot about archaeology, Neolithic archaeology of monuments, Stonehenge and all the rest. And they're all over the world because they work perfectly as localizing the memory palaces. So once you start to settle down and stop wandering, not wandering, but moving around a bigger landscape, you need to replicate it locally or you'll lose that information. A perfect way to do that is a stone shape, as long as it's got a system, or a circle. So I think what we're seeing is their memory systems.
Totally. Yeah.
So instead of making it all, saying they were all living in a fog of superstition and we're the smart ones, that's just not the way it is.
Yeah.
They were using
good
knowledge systems.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have survived otherwise.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. No, in fact, it is, not only is it smart, it is intelligent on levels that seem to supersede some of our systems. We also have very, very good systems. We can make very advanced technology. We can, I don't know, make vaccinations against COVID. And like, we can do a lot of stuff. But I think what you outline, particularly with the diversity of ways of knowing is extremely beautiful, that these normatively slightly divergent, perhaps, ways of perceiving the world would be contributing to a communal knowledge base in some
they
way.
They complement each other.
Yeah. So if you have a stone setting in somewhere close by where you live, then you can basically go out there and start using it as a loci or memory palace.
Which is the way they were. A lot of them had, like Durrington Walls, which is the big one in the UK, had rows and six, I think, circles of timbers in the middle and then circle of stones. What else could it, they know it wasn't a building because there's no drip lines or anything. What, but if you then, instead of just saying they're tall posts, they're totem poles, and we have poles like that all over the world with indigenous cultures, suddenly you've got a university. Or, and instead of a useless, incredible monument, but we have no idea what they did, all of a sudden it becomes, this is how they stored information, this is how they taught, which is why there were little ones in the little communities and big ones in the middle, universities and little, it just all works. All we have to do is acknowledge that these people were had an intellect equal to ours.
What about dancing? Because that's also something that, like, I know people who are dancing. My partner, actually, she's a dancer, and I made the idea to her, say, like, if you're working with dance, you're actually working with a technology of knowing things, and you can start coding knowledge into dance or embodying not new knowledge with dance. Where would you
Absolutely.
direct people to start working with that, like with any particular books or any particular material that where you think that can be
I think what we've got to do is engage dancers to help us with that because, again, it's a different mindset. So you're asking somebody that's pretty neurotypical, not completely. I'll talk about what weirdo I've got. We need their way of thinking. So, in writing the new book, I sat around this table I'm at now. I had ADHD people, dyslexic artists, musicians, and I was astounded when I would ask the simplest thing, and the answers I got were so different from anything that I could have conceived. So you shouldn't be asking me, but I think what's happening is that we have sidelined dancers into a hobby sort of thing. I mean, who would stand up and say, I'm a dancer, elect me for politics, so they have an ability to encode this information. And there's a woman, Australian senior memory, I'm the senior memory champion, as in the oldies one, but the real memory champion, Anastasia Woolmer, is a dancer and she does exactly that. She encodes when she's in competition in that, she's encoding into dance movements.
Wow. Is
Once
that an Indigenous woman or?
no,
Oh, okay. But
no,
she's
she was a professional dancer and then she got
okay.
into memory methods. So what we need to do is take people who think differently and say, all right, I want to get this idea. Instead of just having you there doing something that's pretty, how would you represent something? The other thing with music is it bonds people. It causes a bonding of the group. There's all sorts of things like that. Now, my diversity is aphantasia. I don't know if you've ever heard it, aphantasia. I have no visual imagery. So I keep talking about making images when I can't do that. If I think of anything and close my eyes, I see nothing. It's just gray mush. 4% of the population is like that. So you have to ask, why? And this is across all populations, not just, so everything I'm talking about is universal, innate, and so on. Why would evolution have kept that in? It seems like it's a massive disadvantage. But we have one big advantage. They're starting, the research is fairly new research, they're starting to see other things. But we don't get post-traumatic stress because we can't relive the past. My husband says there's no point in taking me anywhere because I'll have forgotten it. Within a year or so, I can't relive the past, but I also can't relive trauma. So I will weep, well, carry on, recover. So sexual abuse, wars, whatever, I will be able to keep going because I won't be able to relive it. So it's useful having a couple of us, and it's about 4% across all populations. But you don't want the whole population like us. The same with each of the things I've talked about, you want your musicians and your dancers and autistic, and evolution's done that.
You
And
want
our
your autists,
education.
you want your ADHD, you want your dyslexics, you want, so you get the entire panoply of human human, the entire human,
and as that a, has a allowed
space and contribution.
It's allowed the human race to take over the world.
Yeah.
So this genetic stuff I'm talking about, Neanderthals all had as well, and you see art and the same with them. So this combination, working as a group and appreciating those diversities and those skills and the ability to use art, music and dance and narrative as part of knowledge systems,
yeah,
gave humans a massive advantage, and an advantage that we are now not taking advantage of.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you so much. And just before we wrap this up, where can people find your work and your books? Can you mention just a couple of your books? Because you've written several books. You're very productive. And this absolutely amazing topic is being explored in different books. Where should people...
These are my more recent books. I've done over 20 books, but most of them were science and science. And there's the academic one, nobody wants that. So The Memory Code, Memory Craft, Songlines, and I've done ones on spiders and crocodiles and things. They're available at all bookshops, all online bookshops. Yeah. If you, as long as you spell my name correctly, you'll turn them up. There's two writers spelt like me. I don't write about deafness and things. And then the new one will be out in October. But The Memory Code, Memory Craft, and Songlines are the three that cover this topic thoroughly. So cool. Memory Code shows you where this comes from and applies it to archaeology. Memory Craft is the practical, this is how you do it. Songlines is co-written with an Indigenous co-author, showing two completely different ways of looking at the same thing and that they are actually completely compatible.
Okay.
And there's a younger reader, the kids' version of that too.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much for taking the time to get on here. It's an absolutely fascinating topic, and I think it's like... I surely will be diving much more into your writings and even trying to apply it, because I think it has the potential to basically bring wider populations in also in politically legitimate ways into traditional ways of knowing. Like, doing this stuff is not culturally appropriating anyone. It's actually thinking in a different way with and about your world, or being in a world in a different way. So thank you very much also for contributing this perspective to the world and or developing it to the world. Obviously it wasn't you who invented Memory Craft. That's part of your point. Thanks for coming on here. It was super exciting to talk to you.
It's been a pleasure, Rune. Thank you.